You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello, and you are listening to 3CR 855 AM, and you're about to listen to the Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence show, which is broadcasting today to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded, and their ancient and enduring societies are a model of living to the rest of us. So-called Australia is a crime scene, and the genocide is still happening. So I'm just going to go straight into a little spiel I've prepared for today. Before we get to our two guests, I hope you're well this morning, guests. I'm excited today because I have two separate guests. We're going to hear from India, from Friends of the Earth Act on Climate Collective, about the Adaptation Climate Fair held at Borderlands tomorrow. And then we are going to chat about urban spaces, planning, and experiences of said spaces with Rachel from the APR Collective. But first, I have to say something about what Queensland's doing with the puberty blockers. So, sorry, I was just doing my computer reboot whilst I'm also talking. First of all, listen back to yesterday's episode on Thursday breakfast, today's episode on Friday breakfast, to hear some really good information and conversations about these issues. And that will help you get better informed. Also, head to the Trans Justice Project website. They do very good inoculation work with these sort of transphobic and misinformation campaigns that we see coming from the US and UK. And they've been preparing for this BS for some time. And you can also, I'll give you details later where you can find their website and actions happening tomorrow. The recent attacks from the far right on First Nations and trans kids is a typical far right shock and division tactics. There are many players pushing this agenda and these agendas and moral panics. And you really should listen back to this week's episode of Yuliman, where Kieran Stewart Asherton played a segment from the Sunday paper on some terrible stuff being done by the United Church to First Nations on Whadjuk Noongar country. The reason I'm sort of bringing up a church is because one of the things you're probably seeing in the US is this sort of evangelical agenda with some of Trump's appointees. And well, actually, we actually have those groups here in the in Australia as well, so-called Australia, and they are actually quite involved in and quite involved in lobbying and creating these moral panics and, yeah, getting politicians to actually represent their views. And so another one I'd like to throw in as well is the Australian Christian Lobby. Yeah, Passaran, our show on anti-fascism, covers them a bit. But you actually just go to the Australian Christian Lobby's media and related podcasts, and you'll find they're very openly lobbying far-right politicians and creating moral panics against First Nations folks, queer folk, sex workers, and other marginalized groups. Look into the concept of Christian dominionism, which is basically the idea where there is a far-right agenda to take over. And this is something that you'll find on the media of these places. I'm not talking conspiracy. It's literally right there in the open about having a Christian takeover of the government, of the family, and of other aspects of our everyday life. And so this is, it's been called far-right evangelicalism. You could also call it just blatant Christo-fascism. But it exists here in Australia too. And I think it's about time we start getting informed about this crew that are pushing for these things. As I said, they're not the only group. It's not just these far-right Christian groups that are pushing these kinds of agendas, but I think it's important that we start to learn about the groups that are pushing this, like Let Women Speak, who've been a very vocal group about like coming against trans rights. They've actually gotten helps from the neo-Nazi fascist organization, the National Socialist Network, to do their rallies and speakers. And yeah, again, listen to Yanar Passaran and you'll hear all about how the cookers, the neo-Nazis, and the trans-exclusionary radical feminists are working together. And it's actually actually quite common. J.K. Rowling, who's probably a leader of this stuff, is also palling around with fascists on Twitter, formerly known as Twitter. So it's a real issue. And I think the thing about the far right is that they're very good at forming coalitions with each other. Not everyone in Trump's appointees is an evangelical Christian. You know, you've got Musk and whatever RFK is. I think that, you know, one of the things that we need to do is mobilize in solidarity efforts, and we need to get informed. And so tomorrow's protest, I really encourage you to attend or support someone to attend. And then to think about how you can become a joiner with some groups in your areas that might be combating these issues. And we'll be talking to someone from a group that combats environmental issues. And I think that my generation are very good at getting informed on social media, but maybe not so good at joining a group and getting involved. So I would just straight up encourage to think about doing that. Also, if you enjoy, first of all, transjustice.org.au/take action is where you can find the rallies, and it's also the website you can get informed. Also, if you enjoy listening to 3CR, did you know that most of us here are volunteers? That all this wonderful media brings you news and education that doesn't exist in the publicly owned or corporate media, and it's done by activists for free? Did you know that we are the only station to play 55% local Australian music? Did you know that ASIO has a file on us? If you haven't subscribed, or if you need to renew your subscription, do it now. When you do subscribe to The Grid, you can select a show, and you could select Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. There are also other new shows on The Grid who I think would appreciate you putting their name in. Some off the top of my head would be Yilliman, Black is the Essence, and Cultural Kinetics. Please subscribe and help keep 3CR on the air.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial piss.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Kill your lawn and kick your fence. A show about how we live in the cities and suburbs and the ideologies behind them.
Fridays every fortnight at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
Straight from rubbish tip to you.
And you're back listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM. And I'm in the studio today with special guest India. Hello, India.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Would you mind introducing yourself and telling me where you're from, like which organization you're with?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on the show today. I'm here with the Act on Climate Collective. So it's a collective in Friends the Earth, and I'm a community organizer in that collective, helping to push our campaigns around climate adaptation and just action on climate change.
Amazing. And what brought you to this kind of activism?
I guess I actually started getting involved sort of around more Indigenous rights, land back, mm-hmm. Palestinian rights, activism. And then through that, I learned, I guess, a lot about how everything is connected and how, a lot of systemic oppression is connected to also, sort of control and exploitation of the land. And, you know, I think that a lot of the issues with climate change could be mitigated if we had more land back and Indigenous control of common resources.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. I really do think there is a way forward for us to do land back and restitution and justice for First Nations with the liberation that we all need as well.
Mm.
Yeah. You just got to convince more people of that is the problem.
Yes, exactly.
So there's this thing happening tomorrow that's not the rally that I was talking about a moment ago, and I'm going to be coming to this straight after the rally. So it's called the Adaptation Climate Fair?
Climate Adaptation
Fair.
All good. It's basically the same
thing.
So if you're, you know, heading to the rally at 10 a.m. tomorrow, which I definitely recommend you do, come on over to Footscray afterwards. We're going to be having a Climate Adaptation Fair from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. And it's basically focused on everything about community-led climate adaptation. So we're thinking about how can we build resilient communities and work together so that we can face climate impacts collectively, keep one another safe, and also look after the environment and other non-human beings.
Basically a huge theme of this show. So I'm so glad your crew reached out to to wanting to advertise this show, this event. When does the event start and how long is it run for?
So it starts at 10 a.m. And it goes until 4 p.m. So if you're not going to the rally tomorrow, but I do recommend going, come along to our fair. It's going to be at the Borderlands Cooperative in Footscray, which is at 30A Pickett Street. So we're going to be having panel discussions running all day and then workshops running from around midday.
Amazing. So I've looked through the program myself and it looks really exciting. I saw that the first one is Caring for Country and Community Ourselves. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that one?
Yeah, so that's a really exciting panel. I'm really keen for that one. So that's going to be from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. And we're going to be hearing from a bunch of different speakers about Indigenous-led and community-led climate adaptation. It's going to be facilitated by Kim Croxford, who's also in Friends of the Earth, working in Dindi Transition and the Faux Forest Collective. And then we have traditional owner Brendan Kennedy from Tati Tati and Wadi Wadi clans coming down to speak on water care and sovereignty.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I'm really keen for that. And Shweta Kawatra Dakin from Gen West, Amanda Kelly from Women's Health Goulburn, Northeast, and Kate Fawcett from DisasterWise.
Oh, that is a real cool panel.
Yeah.
That's going to be really interesting. We've actually talked about, started to talk about Indigenous water rights on this show with a First Nations academic and activist who's trying to decolonize the water systems and bring sort of sovereignty to it. And it's, yeah, it's so important. I actually, where I live, the rivers are basically expected to dry up in my lifetime from use, from just, and but it's also one of the fastest growing little cities in the world. It's in Wellerong country, it's Geelong. And yeah, basically it's actually kind of like, wow, we are building all this housing and all this like through rapid deregulated urban growth, and there's actually a cost to the resources. So their local public water company is basically scrambling to try and mitigate this, and they're doing some good things, like a, but at the same time, it's like they're doing this because of perhaps how we are approaching the building and the way we use things, and like what you were saying earlier. Like I think a lot of the infrastructure that gets built is still built on this terra nullius mindset.
Yeah, totally. And actually last year the Victorian government held an inquiry into climate resilience, and a lot of the concerns that people and submissions talked about was there's no consideration about climate change and climate adaptation in building permits, in the materials you use. There's no things about building back better. There's no things about, you know, how are we going to actually deal with like the space when we're building these new projects. So yeah, it's definitely something we all need to be thinking about.
Yeah. And speaking of like urban projects, are they thinking about heat impacts? Are we going to hear from people about heat impacts at this thing?
We definitely are. That's the next panel discussion. So that's going to be from 11:35 until 12:15. And we're going to be talking about what are the impacts of heat waves and just heat in general. So heat is actually the number one killer of all combined climate disasters in Australia.
Yeah.
So that's often talked about as the silent killer.
Did you hear about that study where they researched, I think it was the Black Friday deaths? There was like a huge amount of deaths in Melbourne, and it wasn't in the bushfires, it was in Melbourne, and it wasn't on the east side, it was on the poor west side where there were a lot of deaths.
Yes, yeah, because a lot of the times, like, you know, it's not just the climate we're talking about. We're talking about how the climate interacts with the society we live in. So a lot of times people that do not have as good quality housing, they're more susceptible to the weather outside. People with poorer health are more at risk. People that are just generally more oppressed in society are going to be having more serious impacts or consequences from these sort of climate impacts. So we're going to be talking about what are the consequences. There's going to be so Genevieve Cowie from Doctors for the Environment coming to speak about the health impacts of heat. And we're also going to be talking about adaptation solutions. That one's going to be panel discussion will be facilitated by Carmen Lahif Jenkins from Darabin Neighbourhood House Network Climate, who's the climate justice coordinator there. Sophie Emder from Sweltering Cities will be coming along. Beth Hebden from Urban Gorillas and Rebecca Abernathy from Enliven's Multicultural Heat Heroes will also be speaking on that panel.
Amazing. And so we'll move on to the next panel, which is energy comms security during disasters. So I'm guessing that's communications?
Yes.
Yeah.
So more about how we can either have more sustainable, more adaptive energy. So having things like neighborhood batteries, which is like a centralized battery that people can use in disasters that's solar powered. So it's not going to be interrupted during any sort of disaster. Also just general things about, yeah, like how are we going to adapt when power goes out during disasters, things like that. And that's going to be from 12:20 to 1 p.m., facilitated by Pat Simons, who's also at FOE in the Yes to Renewables Collective. And then Wendy Farmer from Voices of the Valley will be speaking, Mark Parnell from Totally Renewable Yakandanda. They're doing a really cool project with the neighborhood battery there. And Jade Ambrose from Mary Beck Tech will also be there.
Amazing. And I keep saying amazing every single time. I've got to change it up for the listeners. Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
And so we're really covering a whole gamut of things. I'm just going to keep running through this program because I think every workshop is interesting.
Yeah.
So creating resilient communities. Who's on this panel?
So this one's going to be from 1:45 to 2:25. And this is going to be focusing on how community and social infrastructure can be used to improve community resilience. That's going to be facilitated by Sarah Powers, who's one of our members in the Act on Climate Collective, Carmen, who was facilitating the previous heat impacts panel is going to be speaking on this one about neighborhood houses and what their role can be in climate adaptation. Sarah Mainsbridge will be coming down from Mullumbimby, and she's in Mullum Cares and going to be talking about how communities sort of come together after a disaster, because obviously they had the really serious floods there a few years ago. Then Anitra Nelson will be speaking from Degrowth Network Australia, talking about all things degrowth and how we can incorporate that, how that's related to climate adaptation. And Elena Pereira from Co-Housing Australia, which will be a really cool panel. I'm really keen to listen to that one.
I have a crazy hair brain scheme, as one of my colleagues would say here, which is neighborhood houses. I reckon we should have one on every block.
We should, yeah.
I love
and
them.
And they should be better funded.
Yes.
We were speaking to Carmen a few months ago doing a community resilience mapping session with a group of neighborhood houses in the northern suburbs. And one of the main things is there's just not enough funding for them to have, you know, sort of backup power in disasters and to provide the sort of relief and safe haven that a lot of the community members look to them for. So we need to get more funding towards neighborhood houses.
Yeah. And I'm interested in this next one because I work outdoors. Climate impacts at work.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool. We have a bunch of union speakers coming on that. That's 2:30 to 3:10 p.m. It's going to be facilitated by Zara Rhodes from the United Work... Oh, sorry, no, just speaking Zara Rhodes from the United Workers Union, Colin Long from the Just Transitions Organiser at Victorian Trades Hall Council will be on the panel. Inga Christianwati will be there from South Monash Legal Service. They're actually got a bunch of climate-focused lawyers who are helping people progress claims related to climate change incidents. And Catherine Strong, who's the Associate Professor of RMIT Music Industry Program. So a bunch of different sort of work-related climate impacts. What your employer is sort of entitled to provide you and what you can do if you're not getting that sort of support at work.
So do you want to tell us about the last one in the program, which is local food security?
Yep. So that's going to be from 3:15 to 3:55 p.m. And it's going to be facilitated by Peter Gartside, who works in the Footscray Community Garden and Learning Place. Zara Copeland from Australian Ecosystems, Nick Rose from Sustain, the Australian Food Network, and Josh Collings from Acres and Acres Co-op. So they're mostly going to be talking about food systems and how we can adapt with our agricultural systems.
That's the other show I do here at 3CR is I do this show that was started by Anne Stanley, and she's usually the host, but I also co-host from time to time, which is... the Local Food Connection show, and you just mentioned a bunch of groups and names that we've had on the show.
Cool. So, yeah. I'll have to listen back to those episodes.
Yeah, and speaking of which, we interviewed this crew called Radical Roots. Yep. Well, that's actually the name of their garden. They're called Guerrilla Gardening Nam. And we did two episodes on them, and they seem to be a part of these workshops that are happening.
Yeah.
You're doing such a great job. You've prepared all this information.
It's a lot. We have so much going on today.
Would you like to tell us about the workshops?
Yeah.
I believe we need to book in to do them.
Yes, you do need to RSVP for a workshop. You don't need to RSVP for anything else. You can just come along to the panel discussions or stalls, but workshops you've got to book in for because limited space.
Yeah.
So I'll just run through the program. So from 12 until 1:15, we've got Asian Australians for Climate Solutions doing a workshop on how to make choices for a sustainable future. From 12 to 1 p.m. outside in the community garden, we've got Very Edible Gardens who are going to be doing A Beginner's Guide to Compost and Worms, which sounds really cool if you haven't gotten into composting before. This would be a great way to learn about how to do it.
And tips, listeners, a worm farm is something small that you can do in a lot of spaces. So, yeah, very exciting thing to learn about, yeah.
Cool, yeah. From 1 to 2, Sweltering Cities are going to do an interactive temperature monitoring walk. So that's going to be talking about heat impacts, but also have some citizen science learning how to use temperature monitoring equipment. From 1:30 to 2:30, Psychology for a Safe Climate will be coming and doing a workshop on climate emotions and collective care. Unfortunately, that one is booked out. This is why you got to get your RSVPs in. And then from 2:45 to 3:15, SES are doing a workshop on how to be prepared for storms and flood emergencies. So if you're worried about what you don't have a plan for what you do if you're going to have a storm or flood, you live in a flood zone, you should come along to that and learn how to prepare yourself and your community for that. And then lastly, like you mentioned, Guerrilla Gardening NAM are going to be coming and doing a workshop from 3:30 to 4pm on commoning and resilient community organizing.
Amazing. And yeah, they're a really interesting crew. I highly recommend listeners to check them out and their little guerrilla garden at the intersection of the Merri Creek and Bell Street in Coburg. So we've covered pretty much everything. Can you maybe just give us some important details about where to go, when it's happening again, and like online where people can find out this like information and book things and stuff?
Will do. Yeah. So it's going to be at Borderlands Cooperative at 30A Pickett Street in Footscray from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. We are going to have a free vegan lunch provided by Food Not Bombs at 1 p.m. until the supplies run out. And there will be hot drinks for purchase by Bean Busker as well throughout the whole day. There's going to be so many stalls. I can't even begin to list them. I think like 20 plus stalls, including the adaptation game, which is a fun little game you can play and figure out how you would adapt in a climate scenario. And it's a fully wheelchair accessible venue. We're going to have COVID masks, looking like it's good weather, going to be a gig at lunchtime. Yay. So it'll be a really fun day, I think.
And there's food.
And free lunch for 1 p.m. until they run out of food.
Yes, so get in quick.
Yeah. Oh, and where you can find information, you could go to melbournefo.org.au/climate and then scroll down and find the event on our webpage.
Could I quickly ask you in maybe 1 minute?
Yeah.
Just a little bit about what some of the projects Act on Climate Collective are doing, because I'm a little bit curious. I've heard a little bit about you, but I'm also curious for this show and thinking about whether or not I should get you on to talk about that another date. So
yeah,
what are some of the projects that you're currently involved in?
Cool. So we're working on community-led climate adaptation at the moment in general, and we're sort of pushing that in two ways. One, working directly with communities to help empower them and upskill them to be able to start their own adaptation projects in their communities through activities like community resilience mapping, and we've set up a Frontline Climate Alliance Victoria to do monthly calls, workshopping how we can progress adaptation. And then we're also advocating for the government to provide permanent and ongoing funding to communities through the Victorian Community Climate Adaptation Fund.
Ooh, okay. I think I might have to get you guys on and talk about this some more.
Yes.
But thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. Oh. It's been really great. And I'm keen to hear more about what you're doing on the show. It sounds really like we've got a lot of crossover.
I think so too. Yeah. Thank you. We're going to go now to a song, and then we will be back with our next guest. Stay tuned to 3CR on your dial.
I take the crown and kill a king. 3CR is radical radio, and that means more than just alternative current affairs and political coverage.
We're radical because we're an independent media outlet owned and operated by the community.
We're radical because we give communities the control of their own shows with their own music in their own languages.
We're radical because we provide a media platform for communities to build their own power to create social change.
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
This is Sophia Belling-Harding, and you can join me on Monday afternoons from 1 to 2pm for Bite, Black is the Essence, on 3CR Community Radio. We'll be discussing all things art, music, culture, and having deadly community members on each week for guest interviews. See you then. Blanket for the stars.
Understand what black is. It's not a colour, it's the basis of all colours. It is not a complexion. It is a reflection.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Sorry if the sound dropped a bit there, listeners. We are in the studio with my second guest for today. Actually, I should back announce that song, shouldn't I? You heard Hogtied by a Melbourne group called Lothario, Melbourne punk rock group. Check them out. And as I was saying, 3CR plays a lot of local music of local up-and-coming artists, so you should subscribe to not just support us, but support the station that supports them. Now, I have a special guest in the studio today with a collective that I'm very excited to get to know. I've sent about 5 or 6 of your members' emails because you all are across different things and it all relates to this show. So I'm just like, when someone I met called Willow,
oh, yep.
Yeah, was like, this collective. And then I was like, wow.
That's awesome.
So who are you?
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. My name is Rachel. It's like kind of trippy to be on the show that like on station I always listen to. So thanks for having me. So my name's Rachel. I'm part of the collective that you were just referring to called Alliance for Praxis Research. So I'm like an urban researcher and I'm really interested in how people use and make public space. Mm-hmm. And I also kind of work in community engagement and have a little side practice when I have time looking at kind of tactical urbanism, mm-hmm. which is just a fancy way of saying kind of really lo-fi community-led interventions in public space. Mm. And so that I kind of dabble in that practice time and resources depending. And then I'm also, I guess, kind of pretty involved with the Greens, running different campaigns there, and with the Save Public Housing Collective, really working at the moment on the campaign to retain the 44 public housing towers due for demolition.
Yes, very important campaign.
Yes, and I feel like a lot of people aren't across it, but when you talk to them, they're really outraged. So I think the outrage is there, just the awareness, you know, we want to work on that. So that's kind of where my attentions go at the moment. I think that's...
Yeah. I like this lo-fi component that you were just saying, because I think one of the themes on this show I want to get out there is like, hey, we don't need what's called Yes in My Backyard, YIMBY stuff. We actually have plenty of stuff.
Yes.
We have plenty of housing. Yes. We should actually be looking at decommodifying and retrofitting, not just building more and more various stories and density kind of living. And so if you ever hear YIMBY listeners, that's what that means. It means basically people who sound progressive, but they're actually just project developers, real estate people in disguise.
Yes, look, I'm glad someone's saying it. I think it's interesting. Like for the longest time, I think Australian housing debate has been really dominated by this idea of NIMBYism. Mm-hmm. And lately there has been a real change in the discourse for the first time in a long time where NIMBYism has really
become on the nose with people, right? Mm-hmm. It's become something people aren't into. And, you know, it's been recognized as a choke point in the delivery of more housing. And I think one of the reactions to this has been the YIMBYism movement, which, you know, on paper seems awesome.
Yeah.
But I feel like when you dig a little deeper, you start to question where their intentions are. But, you know, it's a broad church. I don't think everyone's got the same intentions that would identify as a YIMBY.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting moment, I think, in Australian planning discourse at the moment, this debate, YIMBY, NIMBY. I've also heard QUIMBY, which is around quality development, which I thought was interesting because it's always a quantity issue. We never discuss it as a quality issue.
Yeah.
So it's a changing time in planning discourse and it's long overdue. So yes. I think that's exciting.
Yeah. Well, because we have this thing that's never really left the Australian mindset, which is terra nullius.
Mm.
And so I've been following people who are doing new developments across Victoria,
mm.
and they actually advertise overseas these projects.
Oh, right.
And they do commercials about how much space and open land yes. and big houses.
Yes, that it's just never-ending potential.
Yeah, they're
yes.
just there for yep. the grabs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry that was an important ecosystem
yep.
or sovereign land to First Nations people.
Yes.
We can just keep building.
Yes.
Let's connect Geelong to Melbourne with all these houses in between, like Penrith to Sydney.
Yes, just make it one mega metropolis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the other thing that you said there was NIMBY, and just for anyone who doesn't know what a NIMBY is, it's not in my backyard. Mm. Actually, I saw originally that it was something that was used against people who were like anti-nuclear.
Oh, righto.
Yeah. It was like a pejorative thing for them, but it's really become a pejorative thing for people who are like, I don't want wind farms in my area. I don't want social housing in my area.
Yes. And usually under the guise of protecting neighborhood character and heritage.
Mm.
And also I see NIMBYism movements weaponize trees or just generally greenery and say, well, the more development results in moonscaping, which is where you clear the land completely and it reduces tree coverage in area, which, you know, technically is true with the current rate of quality development, but it's sort of weaponizing an environmental argument to keep a lot of people out of neighborhoods. So it's a messy terrain, NIMBYism, but it is really being challenged, I think, for the first time in like quite a radical way, which
That's
is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So who's the APR Collective?
Yeah, so APR, Alliance for Praxis Research, is a group of, I guess, academic researchers slash kind of community activists. And it formed really organically, as I guess almost all good things do, through a conversation at the pub. And it formed largely out of a frustration. You know, we were a group of PhD students that were kind of entering academia for the first time and feeling quite disenfranchised with the level of activism within the space, or not even activism, just specifically the level of praxis, you know, which is the idea that activism informs research and research informs activism. And so we were like, well, let's just, you know, let's do something. And it started out just, you know, very casually, let's just get together, let's put some events on, let's see what we can do. And it's absolutely grown, like, to a level I don't think anyone was expecting. I mean, don't get me wrong, off the back of work, but, you know, people really got excited by the idea and people are showing up, and I think, you know, beautiful community has been built around it. Admittedly, I've had to step back for a little while, just been overwhelmed with other things, but you know, it grows and more members have joined and it's kind of taken a life of itself, which is really awesome. And it really just came, like I said, out of that frustration that space didn't seem to exist in academia. People are so overworked and it's so heavily casualized. But I understand, but at the same time, I think a lot of people share that frustration, but it didn't seem like much was being done. So we were like, well, look, let's just put on one event and see what happens. And it really just ballooned from there. So,
yeah. Amazing. And so I read this thing called the Praxis Manifesto on the website, which you were telling me a moment ago you haven't read for a while.
I haven't read it since we wrote it, yes.
But it was basically anti-neoliberal.
Yes.
And it had themes of decoloniality.
Totally,
yeah.
Yes.
So could you maybe explain to the listeners what the problem is with neoliberalism and the sort of settler colonialism mindsets that are, in your view, just like what's happening and maybe why they aren't the answer to our problems?
Yes. So, I mean, look, in academia in particular, I think neoliberalism is really kind of one of the big reasons why people just don't have time to engage in activism, the way that the sector has really become, you know, this idea of public or publish or perish, and you're coming to have to always hustle for grants and you're having to always, you know, line your research up to achieve that. And so people are really time poor. And I think it's taken away people's rights, not rights, sorry, people's time and capacity to be active outside of academia, but also active inside of academia. I think it has sanitized it a little bit. And this, I'm not like saying everyone, there's incredible activists that are still very much in the system.
but universities aren't protecting academics and their freedom. Their was it freedom of academia or something? I forget what the term is. The next show talked about it like a week or two ago.
It's just, they operate as businesses. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They operate businesses and the institution is always looking to protect itself, not as people. And I think it's people at best are viewed as capital, you know, as the product that they're selling. And increasingly, I think academics are being positioned as consultants that can benefit private sector that that partners with the university. And so I think all these things are just very slowly, they've been around for a long time. It's not new, but it's just getting worse and it's slowly eroding the sector. And you see a lot of people burnt out and you see a lot of people leaving. And equally so, you see a lot of people not entering in the first place because they're quite put off by these sort of practice. So
I have an example from my experience at university. Going almost a decade ago. I'm getting old, shit.
You're aging yourself.
So it was University of New South Wales,
yes,
and they were moving to trimesters. It was a big deal. Across the news. And basically what they were saying to the academics was they had to then produce either three journal articles a year, like one for each semester, or a book a year.
Yeah, that's the public or perish model.
Yeah.
If you're not just churning it out.
Yeah. Yeah, that is crazy.
Yeah.
I was doing my honors thesis, right? And it was in music. So I was lucky because half of my honors thesis was a performance.
Oh, practice based. Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a lot of work. That took me actually a year and a half.
Totally.
I had to defer because I got stressed out of my brain. But like,
it's a lot.
Yeah,
and that's assuming you really want to like get in there and do quality work. I mean, I'm not saying academics aren't doing quality work, but the conditions are making it harder to do that.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so we're just going to go to a short break,
sure.
And then we're going to hear more about your work.
Cool. Thank you.
No worries.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, you may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
Yeah.
And that's right, listeners, you are listening to 3CR 855 on your AM dial. You're with me, Amy, and you are listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, in case that wasn't clear from that little sting there. And I'm with Rachel today, talking about all things urban and urban space. And let's chat now a little bit about your PhD. And this sort of, I saw this quote that I'm just pulling out of there. So maybe tell us about your PhD, but also about this nexus between the formal and informal city.
So it's in a nutshell, that actually is the thesis topic. But I guess I'm, you know, like my focus area more broadly is public space, but more specifically what I'm really interested in is, I guess, that tension between top-down city governance and top-down interventions in the city. So things like planning, securitization, regulation of space, and kind of bottom-up resistance, and how people resist that in a very everyday way. So not necessarily talking about mass assemblies and mass protests, but more like, you know, how people turn public spaces that have one primary function into a secondary, more social, more radical function. And I think there's this really sweet spot where these kind of two elements intersect. And I guess what I'm trying to argue is that you've got the formal city and you've got the informal city, but they don't exist in isolation. They exist sort of in direct opposition to one another and in direct tension. And where they come together, I think there's this sweet spot that sort of makes a city. Like, it makes what we feel to be a city. And so I'll give you one example. Like, an example I kind of always go to is, you know, if you look in Melbourne, if you look to Flinders Street Station, the steps out the front, you know, there's almost always people sitting there, hanging out there. You know, you got this kind of idea of meet me under the clocks. People are turning the stairs, which, you know, is what the function is just a place to transit. But people have kind of found a way to make it into a very informal gathering spot, or even just a resting spot. And so I think you've got these kind of little instances like that that happen all over the city all the time. And I guess my argument is that they're collective contribution is that it creates what feels like a city. Like, that's you know, that's where a city forms, is at that, in that nexus of the informal and the formal.
Cities are interesting in terms of their history in this regard, because it's funny, because one of the things that is being talked about now is 15-minute cities, which could be a good idea depending on the agenda behind
it. I've heard some conspiracy theories.
There's some people who think it's going to be some sort of authoritarian zoning dictatorship. But the city, if you think of just walking through, like, Melbourne, you just walk down, like, one section of a street. You've walked past a whole gamut of people from a whole gamut of socioeconomic situations, from the poorest to the most wealthiest. And you walk past a whole bunch of buildings that have many, many things going on in and around them. So I think that's quite interesting. So you're sort of saying that this informal city is a thing that we need to sort of care for and promote and build?
Yes, totally.
Sort of like the right to the city kind of?
Yes, exactly. It's the right to the city, which is this sort of theory advanced by, not to get too theoretical, but originally by, you know, one of these French philosophers, Lefebvre, and more recently by critical geographers like David Harvey. And the idea is the city, you know, the right to the city is more than just the right to collective resources and the right to manage a city, but it's actually the right to change a city, and in doing so, change yourselves. That's I'm paraphrasing, but the rough idea. And so I think, you know, a lot of literature and writing on the rights of the city does focus on the right to protest and assemble, which is so important. But I guess what I'm interested in is that really more minutiae, everyday micro forms of resistance, of spatial resistance in the city.
Could you give us some examples of spatial resistance?
Yeah, so I think, like, because I, you know, I interview a lot of people in public space around this, and, you know, like, some of the really simple ways is, like, if you're sitting on the curb, you know, like, I know that sounds so arbitrary, but
no, it's the coppers might walk past and say, get off.
And that's the thing, and there is an embodied politics to that, because one body sitting on the curb is whatever, it's just part of urban life, and another body sitting on the curb, it's all of a sudden the right to trigger a move on law, you know, so there, it is extremely politicized. So I think, you know, you can use forms, physical forms in our urban fabric in a way beyond what they're prescribed. Like, I think a great one is, you know, in Melbourne, at least, you know, bollards. We had a bunch of bollards pop up over the city after a couple of, you know, really horrific incidences where weapons were, vehicles weaponized.
Yeah.
But, you know, people were not super happy with these bollards when they came up. They thought they were kind of an excessive force in public space. But now you often walk past and people are sitting on them.
Yeah.
People are using them as somewhere to rest and have a cigarette, chat on their phone. You know, so there are ways that we, in very subtle everyday ways, where we like resist the kind of function of different forms. And in doing that, create our own public spaces. And I think often we do that where public realm design has failed us. Like, you seek out these alternatives almost instinctively because we don't have the right options in our public, in our urban form. Like, I think our urban form design in Melbourne's pretty woeful. So people seek it out. And I think there's something to be said about the appeal of why sometimes wanting to adapt and change a formal space into an informal one is slightly more appealing than when public spaces are very manufactured to have that same feeling. It doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can kind of build this big, beautiful square, but if there's not something to resist, it almost doesn't feel as appealing and organic to people. That's what I found in my research anyway. Yeah. There's almost this instinct to want to be in more subtle spaces. Yeah.
And so does your research touch on the surveillance of these spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry, I realized I didn't answer your previous question, which is how to protect it. But
it's okay.
That intertwines with surveillance, which is, you know, I guess what I'm interested in is like, cool, you know, we can identify this important cultural, spatial, or what I would call socio-spatial practice. But how, if we can identify it as important, how do we protect it? And I think this is this governance challenge I've arrived at. I've just finished writing this chapter, actually, which is that if you try to use really formal mechanisms to protect and preserve an informal and reactive practice, you seek to just nullify it. Like, you kill what made it appealing in the first place by trying to, like, protect it. And it's, you know, it's like when cities come in and they make street art legal because you can't beat them, join them, and then all of a sudden no street art wants to go to that stretch.
And then a particular group of mural artists seem to start getting all the work.
Yes. You know, so it's like when there's these kind of very formal interventions in informal culture, it kills it, even if the intentions are supposedly good, you know. And so I think, but then you're kind of faced with this challenge, which is if you leave it unvalued and you leave it unregulated at all, unprotected, I think it becomes susceptible to a lot of other urban forces. And one of the big ones is securitization. Like, that's sort of a big challenge, is that, you know, I was speaking with people who kind of work in culture and heritage in different city councils to understand what their appetite would be to protecting practices like this. And their big feedback is always like, well, security would trump all of it. Like, if anyone can argue this as a safety threat here, we can't do anything past that point, which, you know, I think is valid, but it's a fine line where security becomes weaponized to just stop practices we don't want.
And we also, I kind of would argue there that we want community-based security.
Right, exactly.
We don't want state-based security protecting state and corporate interests, which is what the police are.
Exactly, yeah. And so it's
and private security. And They're also a big player in this space. Totally. We shouldn't underestimate
no,
them.
No, totally. And I think Fed Square is a great example of that, because Fed Square is, you know, a lot of people probably don't realize, is a privately managed public space.
Yes.
And they, you know, employ private security. And you feel that when you're in the square. It doesn't feel truly civic because you've got a private security guard doing the laps.
Yeah.
And even if that security guard is just doing the laps and it's just the optics of surveillance and the optics of, you know, whatever, safety. I say in air quotes, but I realize people can't see the air quotes. you know, it completely changes how people engage with that space. So, yeah, I think you're right. Private and public security is a big factor. And so I wonder if there is a way to, like, use cultural practice to resist this.
So we've run out of time.
Ah, that was so quick.
Yeah, but I'd love to have you on again at some point to talk more. We can get this is a good episode to just introduce us to you and this project and these ideas.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
Then maybe we can have a focused interview at a later date.
Grand. Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, so how can people learn more about the APR Collective?
Yeah, great. So definitely we've got a website, Lines for Praxis Research, but probably social media is the most sort of, you know, up-to-date medium. So Instagram would be, yep, if you just type in Lines for Praxis Research, and any kind of upcoming events will be noted on there. Yeah.
Ah, well, thank you for coming in
today.
Thank
you. Yeah,
and
so fun.
And thank you to India as well from Friends of the Earth.
We love them.
And head to Borderlands Cooperative tomorrow for that sick event. And don't forget the Trans Justice Project's countrywide protests and heading to their website to learn more. You've been listening to Kill Your Lawn, Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM. You can follow us on Instagram at Kill Your Lawn. 3CR Kill Your Lawn and 3cr.org.au/Kill Your Lawn. Don't forget to subscribe, listeners. $40 unwaged, $80 waged, $300 solidarity. And I will leave you now with this track. It's called Gravitational Overflow from Air Pressure by local artists Philip Samartis and Michael Vorfield, which brings you field recordings of man-made structures and sounds of the Antarctic with experimental strings. I thought that was a cool theme that relates to what we were talking about. All right, listeners, see you next time.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.